Morning, everybody. Nick, just to let you know, I'm using that mic. Oh, great. It's lovely to be back here again, especially on such a beautiful morning as well. And thank you very much for having me, and I hope that I'll be able to share something which will be useful to you. At home, our house is full of revision, because we have a 16-year-old daughter who is trying to get through her GCSEs, or as I like to think of them, O-levels. Don't know if anyone else is in my camp, but I go back a long way. Great, let's just say a prayer and then I'll share some thoughts. Lord, thank you that we are each vital and precious to you. Lord, I pray that you'll help me to share something of that this morning. And Lord, that you'll sow seeds, Lord, into our lives, which will keep growing for your kingdom, please. In Jesus' name, amen. When Piers was talking about trees, I couldn't help but think about a trip I was fortunate enough to make about 20 years ago to Cambodia. I haven't done a lot of travelling, but I went out to Cambodia with a group, and we went to a place called Angkor Wat. I don't know if you know of Angkor Wat, but I don't know what the trees are, but there they've got these temples which go back hundreds and hundreds of years. And here and there in places, what you see is the tree has grown on top of the temple roof, and the roots come down to the sides of the buildings and into the ground, almost like fingers, you know, holding onto the building, really. It's an extraordinary place. I don't think that's fig trees, but it just made me think of that, really amazing. Trees often feature in the Bible, actually, as an example of us putting down our roots into God, don't they, as well? So, this morning, we're going to think about chosen and commissioned. We're going to have a look at a little bit in a minute from Mark's Gospel, chapter 3. But that's just one of the many pictures you can find now from any of the dramatizations of Jesus and his disciples. I deliberately went looking for some female disciples as well in the picture, although the list we've got only includes the 12 men. What's obvious from the Bible stories is that the women, you know, were key to what Jesus was doing. And so there's a bunch of the disciples with Jesus, chosen and commissioned. I just want to unpack that a little bit along the way this morning. One of the things that came to my mind when I was thinking about this was I met a chap called Mark a few years ago, who I've met a couple of times over the years. And one of the things he said to me was, what was key to his conversion was when he looked at the story of these disciples who were fearful, confused, bumbling along in the Gospels at times, and not least when they all ran away from Jesus the night he was murdered, killed. They then all went on, when you look at history, to die for their faith. These bumbling men who couldn't quite get it at first, something happened to them that they were willing to give everything for Jesus. And to him, that was a key part of becoming a Christian. So I just want to hold that in our minds, really. That's what we're talking about, you know, is these people, men and women, who were prepared. As they grew, as they learned, as they developed, as they were filled with the Holy Spirit, it all changed them little by little by little, really, in their commitment. And he was very, very affected by that. This is a little bit we've got. I'm going to read out the version in here to you. It's from Mark's Gospel. Sorry, it's very small down the bottom there. It's chapter 3, just verses 17 to 19. I think you're making your way at the moment through Mark's Gospel. And, 7 to 19, not 17 to 19. And this is the telling of people starting to follow Jesus, what he did, which drew them towards him, and then specifically when Jesus appoints the 12 apostles. So I'll read this to you. It's not the version up there, but you're also very welcome to look at that if you want. Jesus withdrew with his disciples to the lake, and a large crowd from Galilee followed him. When they heard all he was doing, many people came to him from Judea, Jerusalem. What's the version up there? I've got Idumea. Don't know if that's right, no idea. And the regions across the Jordan and around Tyre and Sidon. Because of the crowd, he told his disciples to have a small boat ready for him to keep the people from crowding him. And there are various stories where Jesus uses Peter's boat on one occasion, which is very key to Peter. For he had healed many, so that those with diseases were pushing forward to touch him. Whenever the evil spirits saw him, they fell down before him and cried out, "You're the Son of God." but he gave them strict orders not to tell who he was. Mark's gospel is action-packed. He doesn't waste time, does he? He races through all these things that Jesus has been doing. And I suppose very much like now, a lot of people are hungry for instant, powerful things, aren't they? They love, you know, they maybe do want God, but they want God to fix everything now, make everything all right. And when that doesn't happen, for some people, that's when they give up, isn't it? And so we then go on to the next part, which is Jesus inviting these people to actually really take him seriously. And it won't always be about miracles and wonders and healing, actually. So Jesus went up on the mountainside, this is verse 13, and he called to him those he wanted, and they came to him. He appointed 12, designating them as apostles, that they might be with him and that he might send them out to preach and to have authority to drive out demons. These are the 12 he appointed. Simon, to whom he gave the name Peter, James, son of Zebedee, and his brother John, to them he gave the name Boanerges, which means sons of thunder, Andrew, Philip, Bartholomew, Matthew, Thomas, James, son of Alphaeus, Thaddeus, Simon the Zealot, and Judas Iscariot, who betrayed him. First thing you're told, isn't it, about Judas? Poor guy. There we go, gone down in history for that. I've added some descriptions to some of those. And I found it interesting, I made a note when Piers mentioned about the description of Nathanael as being someone who was plain talking. I quite like that. Jesus saw in him someone who just said it, called a spade a spade. You know, I'd never thought on that before. And I like to think Thomas is a bit like that. Thomas just speaks out what he's thinking, you know. And he's gone down in history as a doubter, although thankfully not in this list. Legend has it he went all the way to India. And that'll be further than any of the other apostles went. So I call him Thomas the Honest One, because he doesn't mind speaking his mind. And then you've got these others here. And I think Jesus nicknamed James and John Sons of Thunder because they were noisy and they had big mouths. And Jesus thought, I can make great use of those big mouths you've got. I need people that will just get out there and make a bit of a noise for me, really. And we know Peter is the rock. And it's interesting because Simon, Peter, James and John are thought of as Jesus' closest allies, closest friends. And he had nicknames for all three of them, which I think made them feel part of something, perhaps. I don't know. And then Andrew was very good at bringing other people. It was Andrew that brought Simon Peter, brought his brother. You know, and again, that's for some of us, we're not the big remembered people. But who? No one knows about those people, do they? No one knows much about the person who brought Billy Graham. Imagine that, if you were the person who brought Billy Graham to believe in Jesus. And you never brought anybody else to know Jesus. But what a legacy. You know, and there's lots of probably, you know, for Andrew, he brought his brother. Now, both of them went on to be disciples, but they're very different, Andrew and Peter. Andrew's already been following John the Baptist, so Andrew's already on the lookout. He's hungry spiritually, he's hungry for change. Peter hasn't been doing that. Peter's a different guy, he's a different sort of person, and of course he goes on to be a big leader as Peter. So anyway, there we go, that's the list. Nathanael's not mentioned, although he could be. Some people have theories, I think, about him being Thaddeus possibly, but we don't know really. There's obviously more disciples than in that list. Those are the 12 apostles. So, there we go. And I don't know if you consider yourself to be like any of them, but so what we're going to do is we are going to think a little bit about how we're all different. I've made several attempts over the years to write novelizations which update the gospel story. Years ago, I wrote one called Sons of Thunder, and very recently, just this year, I wrote God in a Caravan. And they're both updating these gospel stories now, as if Jesus was around now. But here's the thing. When I first started to do it, like 20-odd years ago, I was writing this, you know, I was having great fun with these disciples, how they were all rebels and, you know, rough and ready and everything. And I came to this passage, and suddenly in my mind I thought, oh, they've all become Christians now. That means they do everything right, and they're all nice and good and proper. And it was really boring to write about. Because I'd got the picture wrong. I put up there years ago when I first started writing modern version of the Gospels. When I came to the moment when Jesus picked his disciples, I got stuck. Because I imagined that these 12 rough and ready guys suddenly became perfect people. And they didn't, of course. They didn't. The stories of the Gospels show us how they still kept bumbling along. This was just another part of their story. And they didn't suddenly know everything and have everything right. And I think it's important to keep that in mind when we're thinking about these guys. This is one of the pictures of Jesus with his 12 disciples. And I picked this one because I wanted to mention this that I discovered. in a novel written by a German theologian who knows his stuff. There were many groups of young men who banded together at the time of the Romans in Israel to fight the Romans. And what would happen is they'd get together, they would live in the hills, they would be, like, it was like guerrilla warfare, they would attack Romans, and inevitably they would be killed. And from the family point of view, they would think, I'm never going to see my boy again. It's all over. He's gone. He's never going to come back to me now. And that some of them, particularly, we've got, there's one of them who's part of a group of rebels, isn't there? Simon, the Zealot. They were a religious group who particularly wanted to throw out the Romans. So here, this is actually Jesus in the middle. It's a very unusual picture. But it does look like they're a bunch of rebels, doesn't it? And they may have thought that that's what they were signing up to. There are occasions when they talk about swords. The evening of the Last Supper, they talk about swords. And Peter's obviously got a sword because he lashes out and attacks somebody. So then, you know, and at one point James and John say, right, Jesus, those people there, Samaritans, we hate them. We all know we hate them. They're terrible. They're low life. We've seen you've got power. Why don't you just wipe them out right now? This was warfare to them, you see. And Jesus goes, you've got the wrong idea here. You don't know, you don't get what revolution this is. But some of them may have thought they were signing up to this. And it happens today, doesn't it? People use the name of God and the name of Jesus for violent purposes, which is, of course, not the revolution that we're called into, really. I'm right with that, but I do want to show you this next clip. I've got another clip coming up here. This is a little clip from a film called The Untouchables. Because what you have to bear in mind when Jesus chose these particular people was he went outside of the religious system. The way it worked in Jesus' day, I may have told you this before, but the way it worked was if people were spotted as boys to have spiritual potential, to be good teachers or Pharisees or whatever, they would be, from an early age, they would be trained up. They would go to their version of theological college or whatever. They would be invested in and their training would start. If they weren't, they went into the family business. What I love about that is, what does Jesus do? He's gone into the family business. He's not very spiritual. What have the disciples all done? Well, they've gone into fishing and tax collecting and other jobs that we don't know about, but they're not very spiritual. But I think there's a reason why Jesus goes outside, beyond the spiritual system of his day, the religious system of his day, because he knows the corruption that's there. He knows the wrong focus that's there. He knows all the baggage that's there. So I'll just show you this, just while you think on that. This is from The Untouchables. This is where Elliot Ness is looking for some good cops to help him crack corruption in Chicago. And what he knows is most of the police are in the pockets, the pay of the gangsters. It's no good just going to your local police station and saying, I need some volunteers, because they're all working with the bad guys. So he thinks, I know what we've got to do. Well, Sean Connery, playing another good cop, invites him. He says, look, what we've got to do is we've got to go back beyond the system before, when people are just starting out, before they've been corrupted. So let's have a look at this law. See how we do.
Is, who can you trust?
Nobody.
The cops? Nobody.
Because nobody wants you here.
Nobody. Well, then why are you helping me?
Because I swore to uphold the law. And if you believe that, I'll tell you another. Now, who can you trust?
You trust nobody.
That's the sort.
Well, if I can trust nobody, where are we going to get help?
And if you're afraid of getting a rotten apple, don't go to the barrel. Get it off the tree.
I want you to meet Mr. Elliot Nash's.
Yeah.
Treasury Department, how are you? We need a recruit for extended duty. Now, this man is to be seconded to the Treasury Department. We have full cooperation with Chicago.
Barry, who is consistently the best shot of this class?
Williamson and Stone.
Good. Call them out for me, will you? But one at a time.
Right. Excuse me. Are either of the men married?
No.
Good.
You're married.
What's better? I don't want any married men.
to join a force.
To protect and...
Yeah.
And to protect and serve. To protect and... Please don't search for the yearbook answer, huh?
Just tell me what you think.
What I think?
Yeah.
You. Could help.
Well...
Force.
You can help.
Force.
Huh?
With Frank.
Thank you. There goes the next chief of police.
Oh, please don't waste my time, but
where are you from, Stone?
From the south side.
Stone. George Stone. That's your name? What's your real name?
That is my real name.
Now, what was it before you changed it?
Giuseppe Petri.
Jeez, I knew it. That's all you need, one thief and whop on the team.
That you said?
I said that you're a lying member of a no-good wretch.
It's much better than you, he's thinking Irish pig.
No, I like him.
Yeah, I like him too.
He just joined the Treasury Department.
Yeah, okay.
I do like that clip because they're looking for someone who's not been tainted by what the other cops have been tainted by, but also someone with spirit and life and who's not afraid to speak out. And I think that's partly what Jesus was looking for with the disciples he picked, which is why they often do put their feet in their mouth, because they speak and they say what they're thinking and they're not afraid to rattle cages, you know. And Jesus chose these people although society looked down on them. You know, I mean, you know, you get this moment here where he insults him, doesn't he? Because he's an Italian-American. You know, and people would have insulted the disciples. They said the same of Jesus, didn't they? You know, as Nathaniel said in the story we heard, anything good come out of there? Don't think so. And people looked at Jesus and went, well, we know his mum. And we know, you know, there were stories, dodgy stories about his mum, about, you know, who his father was. Who was that? We don't know. We didn't ever find out. We know it wasn't Joseph. Dodgy character Jesus. Dodgy characters following him. And what has Jesus said when he started? He said, blessed, or God is with, the poor and the poor in spirit and the broken and the grieving. And those people everybody thinks is cursed. Everybody thinks these people have done something wrong. And God is with them. And I'm going to show that. And that's what he comes. He comes to these people who are outside the system. And then that's a challenge. And thankfully, you get people like Nicodemus, who is inside the system, who has eyes to see. And Joseph of Arimathea, who's inside the system. There are people who have come up through the normal channels who go, hang on a minute, this is of God. There's a lovely quote, isn't there, where the Pharisees and the Sadducees and everyone, they're talking about how to get rid of Jesus, what to do. Oh, actually, sorry, no, this is the book of Acts, I think. It's how to get rid of the disciples because they've started doing what Jesus was doing. Oh, my goodness, they thought it was all over when they killed Jesus. Now there's this bunch of ne'er-do-wells who are doing what Jesus did. And one of them says, wait a minute, if this is just made up, it will die. If it's of God, it's no good us fighting it anyway. And one of the amazing things about the day of Pentecost is that Simon Peter, who's just a fisherman, doesn't know anything, stands up and delivers this incredible sermon. I'm sure the other disciples were probably going, when he started to speak and he said this stuff they'd never heard him talk about before. So anyway, Jesus picks the unexpected at times, and I'm grateful for that in myself, really. One of the things is they were a mixed bunch. These were all Christians, these people. And my guess is some people you'd lean towards more than others, you know. They all have Christian faith. They would all say in their own ways that they're following Jesus. And, you know, one of my mum's great heroes is Mother Teresa, and I kind of inherited a bit of that from her, you know. Some of the things I love, some things she said, and she obviously tried to live out her life following Jesus. But she struggled with depression a lot, huge amount of depression in her life, but didn't stop her from following Jesus. C.S. Lewis there, great writer, and Ian Paisley. Now there's a son of thunder, isn't it? My goodness. That guy in the middle there is a guy called Shane Claiborne. And he challenges the church. He lives in America. He lives in Philadelphia in a poor part there. And he started a whole Christian community called The Simple Way. And he talks about Christians being ordinary radicals. And one of his sayings, you've heard me say this before, but I can't help but repeat it. Shane Claiborne has done something very big and dramatic and self-sacrificial following Jesus. He just completely changed his lifestyle and went to live in a very difficult place. But he says, get ready, because God is preparing you for something very, very small. Because it's small things that change the world. And I can hold on to that, and I can pray that I can be part of that. And of course, Billy Graham and Theresa May, just to get political for a moment. Wouldn't want to be in the public eye at all, me, as a Christian. You wouldn't please anybody. Once you're a Christian and then you're in the media, you've got problems, haven't you, really? But there you go. There's loads more we can probably think of. But the 12 disciples, the apostles we just named, they would have had differences like that. I mentioned Simon the Zealot, who wanted to kick the Romans out. Who is he working with? Matthew, who was a tax collector who made a lot of money out of working for the Romans, what we might call a collaborator. So, you know, Jesus gathers these people together and says, this is the way we're going to change the world, through these people who were very different, quite a mixed bunch. Jesus hasn't gone, oh, I'll have everybody who thinks like I do. He hasn't gone for that at all. And he continues to do that to this day. So I thought we'd take a little bit of a survey, if this is all right with you. These are very spiritual questions, and I need to answer you if you could answer one way or the other. They're things like, do you prefer tea or coffee? Very spiritual, I would think. So, who prefers tea? Would you like to put a hand in the air if you like drinking tea? A few, yes. Okay, who prefers coffee? Okay, anyone prefer anything else? Oh, there we go, yeah, come on.
Water.
Just water? You drink a lot of water? You're supposed to drink several litres a day, aren't you? Yeah, yeah, very good. Okay, water. A lot of other people love water. Yep. Okay, great. Okay, we'll move on then. Now, do you like a quiet night in or a crazy night out? And you can't have a crazy night in, not according to my survey, anyway. So, who likes a quiet night in? I'm all for that now. Yep. Anyone like a crazy night out? Do you have some crazy night? Oh, look at the crazy night out. Great. See, we need everybody, don't we? We need everybody. Who thinks that the glass is half full and who thinks it's half empty? This is a philosophical one, isn't it? How we struggle with our view of life. Are you an optimist or a pessimist? Who thinks the glass is half full?
More than half full.
More than half full. Oh, I didn't include that. That's brilliant. We need you. We definitely need you. Who thinks it's half empty? Well, I do at times, quite often, if I'm honest. Some people haven't voted at all, I don't think. Right? I think, as I heard someone say, you just say the glass is the wrong size. How about that? Okay, one more. This is very topical. Is it jam first or cream first on a scone or a scone? Hang on, no calling out. You've got to vote. Okay, who thinks it's jam first? I'm with you. Who thinks it's cream first? All these people, right. And anyone have butter as well? I've met people who have butter as well. You have butter as well? And the other side of it is it scone or scone? Who says it's scone? Who says it's scone? Which one's posh? I heard it said that before you've eaten it, it's a scone, and once you've eaten it, it's... There you go. There we go. Now, there's loads more I could do on here. But the point is, we're all, you know, we'll answer some questions in the same way that others do. But actually, if I keep going long enough, everyone will end up in their own little bubble. Every one of us is different with our different life experience. That's vital to Jesus. Our personalities, our strengths, and our weaknesses. Paul talked about boasting about his weaknesses because God could use his weaknesses. That's been a big part of my life, really. I used to think as a Christian I would get better and stronger and really good at worshipping and evangelism and everything. But I was better at that when I was 18. Now, my whole story is very different because I've been through loads of experiences. What I've discovered is those experiences that are difficult often, sometimes heartbreaking, sometimes a struggle, they're bridges into other people's lives, aren't they? Because lots of other people have been through very difficult things. Just this past week, I was chatting to someone who's quite a famous Christian, done lots, ran a church and other things, but has recently been through a very tricky period in his life. And we didn't talk about that really at all. But I just said, how's it going? And he said, well, in the last 2 years, what they found is some Christians have found it difficult with what has happened to them. But people outside the church, it's really opened up opportunities because their life has got more messy. They don't look anymore like sorted out Christians. And other people go, well, that's what I'm like. You know, that's the disciples Jesus picked. It's often that people's lives are chaotic and messy, aren't they? And sometimes one of the things you see is, I'd love to go to church, but I'm not good enough. And what we want to say, of course, is it's nothing to do with being good enough. I'm glad I can go to church because I'm in a mess. And that's why I need it, you know. So, wandered away from the issue. Oh, I know what I was saying. So, you know, we're all different. We all bring different parts of the story. And I suppose in some ways, you know, the worst thing I find is when we feel we have to bury part of ourselves because we don't feel it's very Christian. I'm very grateful that when I went through a crisis, one of the things that happened was I realized I could use movies to communicate about God. All kinds of movies as well, not just nice ones. All kinds of films. That grew out of me having a crisis in my life. But I love film. And God went, well, make use of it then. Use it because anything is usable for God. Anything is usable. It doesn't have to feel spiritual at all. Not at all, really. So, anyway, there's more I could say on that. But we're all different. And we are all a vital part of God's big puzzle. Well, I use the word puzzle because life sometimes feels like a mystery, doesn't it? And on your sheets today, Liz has put a puzzle, and it's for a very good reason, just there in this together. I'm going to give you, this happened to me a couple of weeks ago when I was part of a Liabi mission team. We were all given a piece of a jigsaw puzzle. So I'm going to give you, grab any piece you want out of here, okay? And I took mine home, it's stuck on my computer now. And it's to remind me of several things. One is that if I don't do my bit, the picture's not complete. Doesn't matter who you are or what you can or can't do, picture isn't complete without you. God has chosen this group of people in this place, here and now. You're a vital part of the puzzle. You're a vital piece, like the apostles are a vital piece. So you don't have to keep it. You can throw it away if you want. But if you want to, you can put it somewhere to keep reminding you that God has chosen you and commissioned you for this thing that he's built. Jigsaw. You won't be able to make it all up into a picture, I'm afraid, because I've got some of the pieces left here. But that's life as well, isn't it? We don't get the whole picture. Not now. So just wanted to give those out, really, just before I give you a couple of final thoughts. Part of the calling of Jesus on our lives is an interesting one. We don't just look to the death and resurrection of Jesus for inspiration. We don't just look to it because it's God's way of redeeming the world. We look to it for help, don't we, as well? I was thinking about this. Easter is the core of our faith and our life. But it's not the whole picture. It's like you've got to take Easter, and then part two is Pentecost. It's like Easter part two. Because the thing was, pretty much as soon as Easter was done, Jesus started to talk about the way God was going to help and equip the others. So Pentecost was coming. And Pentecost is Easter part two. And the thing is, Jesus said, I'm going to go away because I'm going to pass on the work to you. And what he doesn't say is, so do your best, believe in yourself, grit your teeth, you'll be all right. He doesn't say that, does he? He says, I will be with you. I will be there to help you. So part of the call is that we can keep looking to Jesus and praying for his help. I was thinking about Corrie ten Boom. You probably know this story, quite a famous little story. After the war, you know, in the war she'd been in a death camp. And after the war, she was suddenly found herself standing in front of one of the German officers who had been in the death camp, the camp in which her sister had died. And he put out his hand and he said, I've become a Christian. And she looked at him, and I bet what she didn't do was go, I'm going to just try really hard and forgive him. She didn't do that. This was a nightmare scenario for her. What she did was she said, Lord, help me. I can't forgive this man, but you can help me to. And that's what we're talking about, whether the small things or the big things. We're not alone. Jesus hasn't said, right, there you go, off you go. He's saying, I'm with you. Whenever you hit a wall, whenever you hit a difficulty, ask for my help. Because I don't want you to try and do it on your own, because that's just self-help, isn't it? That's not following Jesus, really. So we're called to keep saying to him, help me do this, because it's difficult for me to do it. So I just wanted to leave you with that. And finally, you may remember there was a little wedding a couple of weeks ago. And this chap, Michael Curry, became famous, didn't he, really? And there was all sorts of theories about his talk, and people liked it and people didn't like it, and it was too long. Gosh, I thought, if people thought 13 minutes was too long, my goodness, they should have been to the services I've been to, some of them. But anyway, I just got a little bit of this. It's 3 or 4 minutes, really. I just thought, you know, this is what we're called into, really. He talks about love in all its forms, doesn't he? He starts to talk about romantic love, but he's actually saying, but actually it's world, you know, in our own small way, those small things that God is preparing us for, that's the changing love, isn't it? And this is a quote from 1 John 3 I put on. Dear children, let's not just say we love each other, let's show it in our actions, which I think was kind of what he was saying. So I'll just play you a bit of this and then I'll say prayer.
Power in love. If you don't believe me, think about a time when you first fell in love. The whole world seemed to center around you and your beloved. Well, there's power. Power in love. Not just in its romantic forms, but any form, any shape of love. There's a certain sense in which when you are loved and you know it, when someone cares for you and you know it, when you love and you show it, it actually feels right. The New Testament says it this way, beloved, let us love one another, because love is of God, and those who love are born of God and know God. Those who do not love do not know God. Why? For God is love. There's power in love. There's power in love to help and heal when nothing else can. There's power in love to lift up and liberate when nothing else will. There's power in love to show us the way to live.
Stop that there. So you might have your little bit of puzzle with you. I don't know, you might want to just hold it or look at it or whatever. And I'm just going to say a little prayer, really, around that. The call that we have, not only to be following Jesus, but to keep asking when we hit the difficulties that he will help us to do them and not to run away from them. So let's just pray for a moment. Lord, I thank you that everybody here is precious to you, that we are all part of your picture, which is puzzling at times. We don't see all the other pieces. We don't know where it's all leading. Lord, I pray for myself and for everyone here for this coming week, that there'll be times when we need your help, that we won't be too proud, we won't be too forgetful, we won't feel too insignificant to ask that you will help us, like you helped Corrie ten Boom to forgive that man that she met, Lord. Help us when we hit the walls to keep going with your help. Show us what that means, Lord. And thank you that you've called and commissioned each one of you to be part of this big picture, your picture in the world, and that your love really can change things. In Jesus' name, amen. We're going to sing 133, which is a great kind of prayer, actually, offering to God the things that we can't do. It talks about placing into God's hands the difficulties, the times of our lives, the things that will happen. And as we sing about it, let's think about this coming week.